advance a career in teaching. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to The Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very honored to be able to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show speaking with a very, very skilled writer and medical reporter for the New York Times, Gina Kalata, who has a number of different books to her credit and has done very, very important work in her field. And you perhaps have heard of her previous books, including Ultimate Fitness, Flu, Clone, Sex in America, and The Baby Doctors. Her most recent book is called Mercies in Disguise, in which she focuses primarily upon a loving, close-knit family in South Carolina that is struck one by one by one by an absolutely terrible disease that in some ways seems to mimic Parkinson's or perhaps Alzheimer's or ALS. It is a devastating illness, and this is a story of how they confront this terrible ordeal, this terrible reality in their lives, and the mystery that surrounds just what this disease is taken up in different parts of the world, actually. And Gina Kalata has done a superb job of tying together all kinds of, in a sense, conflicting threads to help us understand the painstaking work that is involved in trying to understand a mystifying illness or disease. And the result is this book called Mercies in Disguise, A Story of Hope, A Family's Genetic Destiny, and the Science That Rescued Them. I'm very, very honored to be able to speak with Gina Kalata about her new book published by St. Martin's Press. Gina Kalata, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much, Greg. That was a wonderful introduction, very insightful, because what really interested me about this book was that it was a medical mystery, but it's a medical mystery that was solved by a family, but they relied on some amazing research that went on before them and on some amazing just sort of luck, which they thought was almost providential the way it happened. They couldn't figure out what the disease was. And then what I liked about your introduction was you recognized right away that it's not just a story of, oh, they're struck by a terrible disease and they finally find out what it is, but it's, what do you do when this happens to you? How do you find hope? How do you find strength? How do you not let it destroy you as a family or as an individual? And this family was they were not just articulate, but insightful. And each person had to sort of come to their own conclusion about how to deal with this. I had an editor who very astutely said, don't write this like a reporter would write a report or a story. Write this like a novelist, only everything is true. Write it from the omniscient observer point of view. So every chapter builds on the next. You're telling a story, but you're telling it like a novelist would. One of my friends said, this is fiction, right, Gina? I said, no, actually, it's all true. I couldn't make this up. I really couldn't. Even if I wanted to, I could never invent a story this amazing to me anyway. So I was enraptured by the family and the story.
How did you first?
I was never tired of it.
Right. How did you first encounter them? That is the Baxley family.
Yeah.
And how did you first become aware of their ordeal?
What happened was I got a phone call from a researcher at Duke who wanted me to know that there was a paper coming out in one of the medical journals about somebody who had had used a technique to try to ensure that the baby she had didn't have a gene that would cause a terrible disease. And he said, for this class of diseases, she's the first person that ever tried this. And I said, well, that's kind of interesting, but only if I could talk to her. And he said, well, I'm not allowed to tell you her name, but I think she wants to talk. You can go through her private doctor. So I did, and she spoke to me. And she was wonderful. And then I wrote the story for the Times, and it was like an ethics story. If there is a gene that was mutated, and you had a 50% chance of inheriting it because it was inherited, because if one of your parents had the gene, you had a 50% chance of getting it too. So you had a 50-50 chance of getting it. If you have it, you will for sure get the same disease that killed your parent. You probably get it in middle age. It'll take 6, 7, 8 years to kill you, but it will be devastating, straight downhill, no cure. If you had that gene, would you want to know, would you have children, what would you do about it? So it was kind of an ethics story. And it was on page one, and it had one point, really. That was the point. It had a lot of response. Some people said, wait a minute, so your life is not worth living if in middle age you get a disease? And other people said, well, if you had a choice of not of having it or not having it, or having a child who would get it or not get it, how could you not choose to have a child who wouldn't get it? So that was it. I had an agent who said, well, why, you know, that could be an interesting book. You could write about the science and you could write about the ethics. And I said, you know, it could be really interesting. And really, I thought that's what it was. I thought it was kind of a limited sort of reporter type book. And then I went to South Carolina and I met this family and I realized that this was a real story. This was a story, like I told my friend, if I was a novelist, I still couldn't make it up. It was too amazing. And that's what sort of started this going. So when I started writing this book, I seriously did not know what the story was. And some of these family members hadn't even really told the story. In fact, when I asked them why did they want to speak to me, one of the people said, you know, it was kind of cathartic. I'd never really told everybody this, and he was the one who figured out what the disease was. And he said, I never really told anybody the whole story before, and it felt good to sort of talk about what had happened and how and why. So it was, you know, it took a lot of reporting and and the family had things like videos and photographs and documents. So it would help to document things, and they would tell me their stories, and I would often hear the same story from different people, and they would agree. So I felt pretty confident that, to the best of anybody's memory or knowledge, this was true. And although when they would reconstruct conversations, maybe it was not word for word, but that was the way they talked. I mean, the way they talked was distinctive. For example, one brother said, when they saw that when they traced this disease back by 5 generations, he said he didn't want to just sit there and be slain. And that's, you know, that's not a word I would have used. That was a word that was in his vocabulary. So the words that they used were sort of the way they spoke.
And so it was really important to you to, in a sense, maintain their voice, to not insert your own voice in perspective. And you're right. And that's part of what makes this book so deeply personal, even it is also just so engrossing, as we long to understand, as they did, what was behind this strange mystery. Let's talk first about this family from South Carolina, the Baxleys, just briefly, about what made them a very special family before this terrible reality sort of sets in. I think you tell us at one point they were named the South Carolina Family of the Year back in the mid-1980s. Just kind of give us a sense of what this family was like before all of this sort of engulfed them, and even as it did engulf them, the kind of family that they remained.
They were a very proud and very private family, which is another interesting aspect of this, because you would not expect a family that's very proud and very private to start talking about the worst thing that ever happened to them, the most personal thing. But they were well known in their very small town called Hartsville, South Carolina. One of the sons of the man who first was noticed he got the disease was the beloved family doctor. Everybody went to him. For some people, he was the only doctor they had ever known. He was one of those doctors who would sort of, you know, you could call him at home, and he would rush off to his office to see you if something had happened. He was this loving, caring doctor, extremely religious. They were Southern Baptists, And he would pray with his patients in the hospital if they felt comfortable with it. People would call him Preacher Doc because they had a very strong faith in that family, and it was a Bible Belt town. And they said there was the father, the patriarch, well known in the town and beloved. I mean, everybody knew him. Then he had sons, and one son was a doctor. One son was a lawyer who actually became a state legislator for a while. One son was a dentist, and one son became a neurologist. So they were professionals, and everybody knew them, and they all kind of looked alike. People used to say, one guy said, people would jumble us up. See, this is the way they talk, jumble us up in their minds. I wouldn't use the word jumble, but I like that word, because they all kind of looked alike. They all had these prominent eyebrows and a mouth with a very pronounced Cupid's bow. I mean, I actually, you know, when I see pictures of some of the ones who are no longer around, I can tell they're Baxleys.
Mm-hmm. So the sad spin of this story begins with the death of the family patriarch, Bill mm-hmm. Baxley.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us the symptoms that he demonstrated in the last months and years of his life.
Well, nobody knew that he had this disease at first. And he started sort of getting less and less coordinated. The most poignant one scene that was really stood out in my mind, there's actually several of them with him when he was starting to get these symptoms. One time they were all sitting, they all would come over to his house, and my wife would make dinner after church every Sunday. And one Sunday they were sitting there, and they had like a little package of crackers wrapped in cellophane, and he was sitting there trying to unwrap it, and everybody was trying to ignore it around the table. And they could hear his hands pushing at crackle, 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 crackle. And no one knew what to do, and he didn't want to say anything. Finally, one of his sons reached over and quietly opened the package for him. It's kind of heartbreaking. You know, he didn't want people to know he was losing his coordination. He started stumbling. Walking became increasingly difficult. Pretty soon, he pretty much couldn't walk at all. Couldn't really swallow. Had a lot of trouble talking. He was using an alphabet board. But what's interesting, so they took him from doctor to doctor trying to figure out what was wrong. They even drove him when he was really in, one of the brothers drove him in when he was actually pretty ill to Duke to try to find out what was wrong. And no one knew. They kept saying, oh, it seems like a combination of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. But they said, the brother said, they knew it wasn't Alzheimer's, anything like that, because before he died, right at the very end.
A
week before he died. You're great. You read the book. You're great. He nailed the final Jeopardy question, and they said no one with Alzheimer's would do that.
So even though doctors were jumping to this conclusion, the members of the family had a sense that something else was wrong, and ultimately the answer that is given, but it takes quite a long time for this determination to be made, is that the father.
Don't give it all away. Don't tell them what it is.
Right, right.
Because I want it to be a mystery.
Sure,
that's
sure,
the problem
sure.
Of talking about this book, you know, it's like every chapter builds on the next, and I want there to be some sort of suspense. So if I talk about it, I think, oh my gosh, I'll give it away.
Right, right, right. Well, the thing is, I think very few people will recognize the name of the disease.
That's true. They will never recognize
right.
it. You're right.
So, so Gerstmann-Streusler-Scheinker disease is what is ultimately the diagnosis. But you're right. It is a mystery that stretches out over the course of years. And what we're talking about is a disease that they begin to realize is somehow inherited, passed down through the generations and a part of their family tree. And part of what is quite poignant is when the brothers undertake a concerted effort to contact all kinds of relatives, even distant relatives with whom they've had minimal contact, if any, in recent years, but trying to determine how many of their relatives have demonstrated similar symptoms and ultimately succumbed to this mysterious disease. And that, even that relatively minor point in the book is quite interesting to think about what it is like to have to reach out to relatives who are nearly strangers and try to delve into such personal corners of their lives and broach what is ultimately a very, very painful topic and very dangerous, ominous possibility.
Yeah, can you imagine calling somebody you don't really even know and say, hey, did anybody in your family die in some sort of mysterious way? I mean, you think they would say, what on earth are you talking about? What are you trying to tell me? What's in this family? Because at the time, they didn't even know for sure that it was inherited. They were wondering. They were guessing. And they didn't really know what the disease was. They were just looking for strange, unusual deaths. So it was kind of, you know, it was a kind of a creepy assignment. And I thought they were very sensitive about the way that they phrased their conversations with the long-lost relatives. And I think very brave to even do it. I mean, I would really hate to try to do something like that.
Right.
And they did develop, though, a family tree going back five generations. And one of the brothers who did all this work, it took him about a year. He had he put little red check marks next to people who had died, relatives who died in very unusual ways. It sounded like this disease. That's how. And then he laid it all out on the dining room table one day after that church dinner. After church dinner they always had, and he was this long piece of paper with the little check marks next to each person, next to the little box where each person's name was, if they died mysteriously. And everybody could see that it seemed like something was being inherited. They didn't know what. But what was interesting, once again, this is the way this family saw things. I thought it was a novelist touch again. But I'm not a novelist. Mike, the brother who made the family tree, said that they were all looking at this long piece of paper, and then just when they were doing it, this ray of light came through the window and shined on the paper, and he said it was like it was saying, there is light, there is hope, which I thought was, you know, just a beautiful way of viewing this. It was kind of amazing to me that they would remember and be able to express things like this. Mm. I mean, I don't think I could.
One thing I appreciate is the way you describe as various members of the family begin to demonstrate what look like ominous symptoms of this same disease, how each of them contends with it. And even though it's a story that plays out again and again, each story is its own story. And each person, for instance, each of the brothers, as this enters their own lives, you know, to varying degrees, is probably in a state of denial then, and ultimately acceptance. And in every case, we're talking about tremendous courage that is shown, even in the face of being given such a devastating diagnosis. But I wonder if you could just say a word about the challenge for you as the author of this book to tell all of these stories in a way that would give full due to each of these individuals and what each of them experienced.
Well, it was emotionally difficult just even asking people to keep reliving over and over again their experience of watching somebody they love suffer and die. And it's also, I had to try to check facts. Like one of the brothers, Billy, when he was starting to get ill, one of the first things that happened, he and his friend Steve and Billy's brother and his two children went on a rafting trip, and Billy just kept stumbling and falling. And I had to ask each person, did you remember that? What did you see? You know, what happened? What did you think? When did it come to you that maybe something was wrong? When did Billy say anything? It took a while for Billy to actually decide there was really something wrong, because he was sort of saying, oh, you know, the rocks were slippery, and he kept falling off the raft. So it took a while, And the book went through many, especially those sections, many revisions, trying to get the tone right and to try to get the details right, to make it the story as poignant and compelling as it really was to me and to the people who are telling me the story. It did take a while. With Buddy, some of the most, I think one of the things that really stands out with me, Buddy was a family doctor. And at first he didn't want his wife to know. First he didn't want to say this was the family disease. He was trying to find other explanations. And he was losing his coordination in his hands. And one day, it was over around Christmas, he got a call at home, and a mother called and said that her son had cut himself above his lip, her little boy. And Buddy said, "Come into the office." And then he turned to his wife and said, "You have to help me." And she didn't know what he wanted, but she went along. And then he took her into the back room, didn't want to say this in front of the kid, and he said, "You're going to have to do the stitches." And she was terrified, and he said, just be calm, I'll talk you through it. I can't do it. So, you know, he says, "Is it going to hurt the little boy?" He said, "No, but you have to sort of be firm and just be steady." And so she'd push the needle through, and then she'd look up at him, and he'd nod and say, "Okay," and then she'd do the next one. And then when they went home, and she said, I didn't know it was like this. It was one of those moments where you just want to cry. It says, you know, he didn't want her to know. He didn't want to say this was a family disease. But this was the moment when his wife knew something was really not right.
Right. And, of course, the brother, who is a dentist, has to confront the reality that the disease is progressing to the point where he can no longer safely work on a patient. I mean, that he is losing such control over his own coordination that there's the very real possibility that he's going to hurt, even injure a patient. And we so feel for them as they find themselves in this terrible dilemma. But another dilemma that we should talk briefly about before our time is up is that as Mike, who is the person who really undertakes the construction of the family tree, is compiling this information about this still mysterious and as yet unidentified disease that is striking down so many in this family. He says at one point, "The project posed an impossible ethical dilemma. As much as Mike wanted to know, needed to know, what had happened to his father and what might happen to any of them, he did not feel it was his right to force that knowledge upon others." In other words, this question then arises about the difference between a person who wants to know everything they can possibly know about what is in their own future versus those who might choose, for whatever reason, not to know, not wanting to know that a death sentence hovers over them. I should think that also was a supremely important challenge for you, to try to do justice to this really intriguing difficulty.
It is, because especially when they found out what the disease was and they had a choice of having a genetic test, a blood test, to tell them if they had inherited the gene or not, there's no right answer. And when people say, "Oh, here's what I would do," I feel like saying to them, you know, you don't really know until it happens to you. And you can't tell people, you should know. Don't you want to know? Do you want to have children? You can't do that, because there is no right answer. And knowing your future is not easy to live. It's not easy to live with it. One of the people who did find out that she had the gene, she talked about how it changed her. She thought she was prepared. She thought she knew what it would do to her. And she really didn't know. She said, "You can't know until you find out you have this gene." She said it hardens you in a way. You sort of feel like things that, you know, used to really be important are not so important anymore. And she said also, because she doesn't have, she knows that her time of being healthy and alive is limited, she says she feels like she has to make every day count. You can't just sort of say, I think I'll just lie around and watch TV today. You think, no, I don't have that many days left. So it, you feel like, you know, you have to plan, make, you know, I want to do this, I better do it, because if I don't have that many days left. And she said it's interesting how it changes your relationships with people, and it changes your day-to-day life in a way you would never expect.
Right. And, of course, the other thing that we have not even talked about is the different ordeal, but an ordeal all the same, for those who do not have this gene and
Absolutely.
Who do not succumb to this disease, and, in
Right.
a sense, the survivor's guilt that they feel. And those who have this gene resisting the natural impulse of resentment towards siblings or others who are spared this ordeal. And one thing that is so inspiring about this story, although we should not paint them as nothing but saints through and through, these are really good people and remarkably loving and courageous and sensitive, even in the very worst that life can dish out. But particularly
but
for those
like really human people, because they have their own difficulties, and you know they have to work things out. They're not saints. You're right. That's the other thing. You know, you don't want to pretend that they're somehow on a level that's not even human. They're not. But they dealt with it. You're right.
It's a remarkable story, and of course, a fascinating scientific story as well. Not only of this family studying what is going on, but also other scientists around the world trying to get at the heart of what this mysterious disease is all about. Well, we leave it to our listeners to explore more of this in your remarkable book, again called Mercies in Disguise, a story of hope, a family's genetic destiny, and the science that rescued them. Published by St. Martin's Press and the author Gina Calata. Gina Calata, thank you so much for writing a beautiful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you. It was great. Thank you.
And the time is exactly 8:37. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part two. We are going to be spending the next few minutes talking about Lyme disease, a scourge all around the world. It is something that is spreading rapidly and causing all kinds of misery. It is a relatively mysterious disease, and one we are trying to come to grips with. One of the best resources to which someone can turn to know more about it is a book called How Can I Get Better? An Action Plan for Treating Resistant Lyme and Chronic Disease. And the author is Dr. Richard Horowitz, who has focused much of his energies on this mysterious illness. He and his wife co-founded the Hudson Valley Healing Arts Center in Hyde Park, New York, which has treated tens of thousands of victims of Lyme disease and related illnesses. The book is published by St. Martin's, and Dr. Richard Horowitz, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you for joining me. Can I ask you right off the bat, only because your book is so has so much great information, but I'm not sure in your book nor anywhere else that I sort of checked quickly, could I find what the word Lyme itself refers to? Why is this particular disease called Lyme disease? Is that someone's name, or does that refer to anything specifically biological, or where is that? What is the origin of that name?
Well, normally, actually, there's a small section in the beginning of the book where I explain the history, but in Lyme, Connecticut, about 40 years ago, there was an outbreak of what they thought was juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, where these young children were coming down with large swollen knees, and they called in Alan Steer from Yale at that point to investigate the epidemic. Polly Murray was the mother at that point, whose son had it and kind of called this in, and that's where they discovered it. So since it was first discovered in Lyme, Connecticut, that's how it got the name.
Right. How I see that right in the fourth line of the first chapter, but I swept right past that reading eagerly about this interesting outbreak, which actually I hadn't known very much about. So thank you for clearing that up. You call Lyme disease the great imitator. Explain what you mean by that, the great imitator.
Right. So the problem with Lyme disease is that it can imitate a broad range of diseases. So, for example, people come to me with a diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome, which has been called many names. It's called myalgic encephalomyelitis, systemic exertional infection disease. In other words, these people have chronic fatigue, muscle and joint pain, memory and concentration problems. They can't fall asleep. And they're just basically told they have fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue. Many are diagnosed with autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, multiple sclerosis. Lyme causes a broad range of psychiatric problems. So if you weren't depressed, you could all of a sudden become depressed, anxious. You can get obsessive-compulsive disorder, bipolar, schizophrenia, early dementia, sometimes mistaken for early Alzheimer's. So it imitates all these different diseases, and because the blood tests are not reliable, people come in and they say, you know, I have this chronic fatigue syndrome, I can't seem to get better, and then it turns out it's Lyme and overlapping factors that I discuss in my book.
I mentioned in the in my introduction how Lyme disease is spreading, and you certainly share some alarming statistics on sort of the scope of this disease. Give our listeners some sense of just how much Lyme disease is spreading, how rapidly, and maybe more importantly, why? What is behind the rapid spread of Lyme disease?
Right. So the CDC came out with new figures several years ago and said it was the epidemic was 10 times higher than we suspected. It was not 30,000, but over 300,000. And the recent figures are about 400,000. But you have to keep in mind that the blood tests for picking up Lyme will only pick it up in maybe about half the cases. So we're probably looking at over a million cases a year in the United States. And that's not counting all the other tick-borne diseases, because when you get bitten by a tick, it doesn't just contain Lyme disease. It also contains parasites like Babesia, which is like getting malaria at the same point. It contains Bartonella, which is a cat scratch fever type of bacteria. There are viruses in there. So you can get very, very ill from this. So the CDC revised the numbers, and then 2 years ago they said that there was a 320% increase in the number of counties affected, where it was spreading from Pennsylvania in all directions outward. And we now know that it has spread worldwide. I was called by the Chinese government years ago as a consultant to fly over to Beijing, and they told me privately 6% of the 1.4 billion people in China had Lyme disease. So we're talking millions and millions of people. It's a full-blown epidemic in Europe. People don't realize that this is one of the worst epidemics we've probably seen in a very long time, and only because the blood tests are unreliable, people don't realize how bad it is.
Wow. Well, the heart and soul of your book is where there is some hope. That is, you lay out some strategies for confronting Lyme disease and dealing with it and treating it. And the sort of the framework are seven central rules for dealing with Lyme disease. And the first one particularly intrigues me. You think we need to be making sure that it is the symptoms that drive both diagnosis and treatment.
Yes, I mean, the fact is that because we're not yet at a stage where the diagnostics are able to pick up Lyme, I developed a questionnaire. It was based on an older questionnaire by Dr. Boroscano, and we, in fact, validated it just recently. We published it in the medical literature. We're waiting to hear back from the journal. But we validated the questionnaire in 1,600 people. So if someone is questioning and saying to themselves, well, I have fatigue, I have joint pain, the key to this disease is that the symptoms come and go. You have good and bad days. The joint pain, the muscle pain, and the nerve pain, which is often described as a tingling, numbness, burning, stabbing sensation, they migrate around the body, and it's one of the few diseases that does this. So if you have pain that's moving around your body without reason, and women are often worse right around their menstrual cycle, and then you take antibiotics for an unrelated illness and you say you feel better or worse, that usually suspects that you might have Lyme disease. So what I describe in the book with the symptoms, the reason we go through this is because the symptoms really do tell you where you need to focus. The first question on the questionnaire is sweats. Now, for example, around where you are, there are big cases of babesiosis, which is this malaria organism. The first question on the questionnaire is, do you have day sweats, night sweats, flushing, chills, air hunger where you can't catch your breath? Those are symptoms of babesia. So if someone fills out this questionnaire and I see symptoms of sweats in a young man, I say to them, well, I don't think you have menopause. You must have some other disease. So we go through the differential diagnosis. And then in my book, what I really go through in detail is that there are 16 reasons why people stay ill. And it's an analogy like someone who goes into a doctor's office with 16 nails in their foot saying they have foot pain. If you don't pull out all the nails, you're going to stay sick. And what we find is it's not just Lyme. It's other infections. It might be that people are not falling asleep. They might be eating the wrong foods that they're allergic to. They may have a problem with their blood pressure, which happens from the Lyme disease. The hormones are thrown off. Many of the doctors don't think about looking for these things. So really, if you have any form of a chronic fatiguing musculoskeletal illness and your memory's off, it's worth taking a look at the book, going through the questionnaire, and working with your physician to go through these 16 points to see whether you might in fact have something that's causing an inflammatory response in the body.
It's too bad that all cases of Lyme disease don't include that iconic bullseye-shaped rash that some people suffer from. If it was always there, then knowing that you have Lyme disease would be a simple matter indeed. But of course, as you rightly point out, it's much more complicated than that. You explore other matters, including lower inflammation. That is such an important key for so many sufferers of this. Say a quick word about the importance of detoxification, which is something that is important for the well-being of the body and something which is often compromised when someone suffers from Lyme disease.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting that when people, for example, get memory and concentration problems, most of them think, well, I just need to put in an IV line and get IV medications like Rocephin. But the fact is that there are neurotoxins in the body, and what we've been finding looking at patients is that many patients now are showing up positive for mercury, for lead, for arsenic, for all kinds of heavy metals. About two-thirds of our patients are now showing up with mold toxins that are in the body. We're finding pesticides in some people, especially with Parkinson's disease. So we now know that there are 300 to 500 chemicals getting into people's bodies every day. Most of these are carcinogenic. They act as foreign-based estrogens. So when we detoxify the body, we find that about 70% of the people who have fatigue and joint pain and memory problems get better. So I describe in the book in detail the kind of detoxification therapies that we use. And in fact, even though I don't have Lyme disease myself, I take a lot of these type of supplements and things to open up the detox pathways because my whole family's had cancer, and I want to get these chemicals out of my body. So, you know, in the title, when I talk about treating resistant Lyme and chronic disease, what I'm also referring to with the chronic disease is that even somebody healthy, if you read this book, you'll realize that infections and toxins are causing many people to be ill. And that's why I have a concern, by the way, with deregulating pollution controls, because I don't think people realize how much the pollution on top of the infections is making people ill. And detoxification is absolutely essential in a large number of the people coming to see me.
I appreciate how your book explores other matters, including that of not only restoring physical health, but also healing the emotional wounds. And our last minute or so, can you say a quick word about why that warrants the attention that you give it in your book?
You know, there are some old studies on what's called psychoneuroimmunology, where there's a direct relationship between the mind and the body and how your immune system functions. And many of the people who've come to see us, they've been to 10 to 20 doctors. They're told it's all in their head. What I usually like to tell them is, well, what's really in your head is infections and toxins. And unfortunately, these people come in with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, or there's been issues of abuse early on. What we find is if we don't help people with the mind-body connection, that it's not just enough to take antibiotics or herbs or detox, you also have to deal with the emotional wounds that have taken place. And in some people, it's one of those nails that's actually quite important. So people just need to look at the entire picture and figure out all the overlapping reasons of why they may be ill, and that's what I go through in detail in the book.
The book, again, is How Can I Get Better? An Action Plan for Treating Resistant Lyme and Chronic Disease, published by St. Martin's Press, and the author, Dr. Richard Horowitz. Dr. Horowitz, a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for the good work that you and your staff do, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you so much.
And it's 11 minutes before 9 o'clock. This is the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. And to finish out our program today, here is an excerpt from a conversation I recorded with Kat Duff, the author of an intriguing book about sleep. It's called The Secret Life of Sleep, published by Atria Books. Here is an excerpt.
But in fact, lots goes on in our sleep. We keep thinking and feeling and going over things in our sleep. We practice our skills. We remember things. We weigh variables. We solve problems. Have you ever had the experience of being bothered by something when you go to bed and you wake up the next morning and you get in the shower and all of a sudden it dawns on you, oh, this is what I need to do? That's because your sleep has been working on it and figuring it out. So they do relate very much to each other, but they have this kind of invisible line between them.
Mm-hmm. I remember that from, I think, the 11th chapter of your book, Knitting Up the Reveled Sleeve of Care, Emotional Restoration, when you tell us that that we are beginning to understand the role that sleep and dreams play in what you describe as managing the emotions that often get the better of us by day. Do we understand the mechanism by which that restoration or process of kind of making sense of things, how that happens when we sleep, when we dream? What's going on?
We're learning more. We don't understand it all, of course. But part of what we do in our dreaming lives, and by the way, even people who don't remember dreams still dream. That's been pretty well established, is that we kind of reiterate the issues that are bothering us and kind of dramatize them in different ways in order to scale down the upset, in a sense. I think that's why the Irish say, you know, a good laugh and a long sleep are the best cures. Or it's also said the best bridge between despair and hope is a good night's sleep. How exactly we make that shift from being overwhelmed and discouraged and despairing at night and waking up the next morning and ready to take on the day involves both the dreaming sleep where we go over the things that are bothering us, but also that deep sleep where we let it all go and we kind of empty out. And I think it's the combination of the two that really does the trick.
Mm. Of course, there are all kinds of people who have all kinds of difficulty with sleep, with falling asleep, with remaining asleep, and it seems like these are numbers which are escalating. One of the most curious phenomena, of course, is the fear of falling asleep. You give us a couple of different names for that, hypnophobia or somnophobia. It's such an intriguing, and I'm sure for the people who suffer from it, very, very troubling condition. What do we know about this curious experience of those who are actually fearful of falling asleep? What is going on there?
Well, it's kind of a hypervigilance. You know how if we're walking down a dark street at night, we have all our antennae out to see, you know, what's lurking in the shadows, if there's any danger around. We're hyper-alert, we're hyper-vigilant. Some people, their nervous systems have a hard time letting go of that hyper-vigilance. And I have a couple of friends who are like this, who are chronic insomniacs. They get close to sleep and then something suddenly wakes them up. What if this or that is going on? What do I have to listen to? It may be carried over from times in our evolution or our history when we lived in more dangerous times, when more was afoot that we had to watch out for, or it may be a function of being overstimulated in our world. Now we have, you know, lights and sounds and TVs and everything is blaring, it seems. And it could also be a function of when people have been left alone to cry as babies too often, what can happen is that their nervous systems get extra sensitive to stress and extra taut, and then they may grow up to be people who can't fall asleep or stay asleep.
One really intriguing thing in your book is when you talk about the booming sleep industry, and in particular, how sleeping pills are such an important, profitable part of the pharmaceutical industry. And yet, you tell us very persuasive evidence that indicates that, in fact, most sleeping medication, sleep aids, do almost nothing to actually help people sleep. Tell us more about what these studies show.
Yeah, it's remarkable. One in four Americans take a sleep medication every night. And what the studies show is that, on average, sleeping pills give us an extra 11 minutes of sleep. What they do is they usually shorten the time it takes to fall asleep, so there's less time for that anxiety and that sleep dread to build up. But more importantly, what they do is they lower anxiety, so we just feel less worried about whether we're going to get enough sleep or not. And we don't remember our nights when we wake up in the morning, so it feels like we're more rested when actually we just got 11 more minutes. And in fact, most sleeping pills will actually shorten the time we spend in dream sleep and in the deep sleep that is so physically regenerating. So chronic use of sleeping pills will actually accelerate our aging because we don't spend as much time in that deep regenerating sleep.
Interesting. And it's so interesting. You tell us about these results, and then you write, "I can hear my friends who take Ambien nightly protest that it is not true, insisting they sleep more and do better the next day with the drug." But you tell us lab studies consistently report that people think they get more sleep when they take medication than they actually do. In other words, people do not generally do all that good a job of assessing their own sleep, and in particular, how their sleep has been positively or adversely affected by something.
That's true, because, of course, we don't remember our sleep. An interesting study has come out since I wrote the book, demonstrating that if someone is told they had a good sleep, they actually do much better that day and perform much better as if they did have a better sleep, even if they didn't. So there's a certain value in that placebo effect of thinking that you got better sleep than you did, but of course it's limited.
Well, and when I underwent my sleep study, one of the things that was difficult for me was to answer all the preliminary questions about typically how a night of sleep unfolds for me. And then when I had that first sleep study and awoke the next morning, it was very difficult for me to answer those questions, such as, how many times did you wake up? How long were you up? I mean, how long did you deeply sleep? Did you dream? I realized that those were all questions that were really hard for me to answer. And, of course, that circles us right back to one of the first points we made in this interview, that the study of sleep is very, very difficult, and it probably always will be.
I think you're right. Stanley Korn, who was one of the wrote the earliest books about sleep, told this great story. He said that he had a really bad night of sleep. He was awake all night. In the morning, he was telling his wife when she woke up, "Oh, I never slept. It was terrible." And then they noticed there was dust on the bed. And he looked up, and the ceiling had cracked, and plaster had fallen onto the bed. They had slept through the earthquake in San Francisco, and he thought he had never slept. So our perceptions oftentimes of our sleep, insomniacs saying that I didn't sleep a wink, or people saying I slept great the whole night, are sometimes off from what really happened.
Right. I mean, those electrodes attached to your temples, those don't lie. But
they
sometimes paint a picture that's really hard for us to understand. Well, for much more information about the mysterious experience of sleep and its undeniable benefits, we can turn to your book, again titled The Secret Life of Sleep. It's published by Atria Books, the author, Kat Duff. Kat Duff, thank you so much. I was intrigued by your book on so many levels, and I know many people will find a lot to drink in and ponder. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I'm very excited to welcome into our studios one of the country's most highly regarded choral composers, Jake Runnestad. He is a special guest of Dr. Peter Dene and the music department at Carthage College for the next couple of days. And we will be talking with him about his career and about the pressures and pleasures that are part